believe it's only been 1 week ago that Jacob Blake was shot in the back by a police officer in Kenosha. It appears that he was, police were trying to arrest him, they say, on sexual assault charges. We've seen the video as part of the event, maybe not all of it. Several days later, we saw 17-year-old Illinois resident Kyle Rittenhouse from Antioch traveling to Kenosha with a rifle to protect Kenosha's business owners during the unrest. He ended up shooting three people, two fatally and one who he critically injured. And he's being charged with intentional homicide and reckless homicide, along with illegally carrying a gun. So this brings up a lot of issues of self-defense, how these cases are going to be tried, and what kinds of force can you use as a police officer and as a civilian. With us to discuss these issues is Dan Herbert. He's a regular on our show here. He was a Chicago police officer for 10 years, winning the Distinguished Service Award. He attended night school and has a master's in criminal justice, and he is now a lawyer representing police officers and other people in other matters. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
Doing well. Well, here we go again. I'm sure you've watched this video. Tell me what your assessment is of what happened.
Well, I have watched it several times, and, I have not seen an angle, and I'm not sure if it exists, but when they had him on the ground, you can tell the police officers both reacted as if they were in, imminent fear. They both jumped back and pulled their weapons. So, I don't know what exactly happened there. I'm not sure if he had pulled a knife at that point, but it's a video that does not look good, and it doesn't look good for a number of reasons. Most importantly, I think, is, it appears that a lot of these shots were in the back, and it appears that, he was not necessarily an imminent threat to the police officers. However, if in fact he was reaching for a knife, which seems to be indicated was on that the floor area, then that could be a justification. But it's difficult.
So let's just say, and again, there's a lot of supposition here, and we don't have all video, as you said, and we don't even know what started the whole thing, and we don't know all this. We hear rumors, but let's just say that what we did see, he's walking around the car. Blake is walking around the car, and looks like the police are trying to stop him, and apparently he was tasered before, and he does look like he's lunging for something. Let's just say that the police saw that knife, or saw that he was reaching for that knife. Tell me how that gets parsed by jurors in this case, and how you make the argument for the police officer that he was justified in using lethal force.
Yeah, well, a lot depends on, how close he was to getting that knife. Also, how big the knife was is going to be an important factor for a jury, even though, the size of the knife is not that relevant in which respects to it being a deadly weapon. Clearly, a knife is a deadly weapon in the hand of somebody that is resisting police. So the big question comes down to is, can the police explain, which unfortunately they're going to have to do in this case, there's really not going to be a presumption of innocence. They're going to have to explain why this threat was so imminent that they truly feared that this individual was going to have the ability to pick up that knife and cause damage, great bodily harm to them.
And, as in the Jason Van Dyke case where you represented the police officer, there's a lot of talk about the defendant, and he had a criminal record. And how much of that does the jury really care about? Do they care that he was being arrested for some sort of sexual abuse charge? I mean, he was never convicted of that. That we know about. So how much of that gets put into the record, and how important is that for the jury to know those facts?
Well, it's important from the standpoint of the fleeing felon rule, where police, that's really what separates police from a private citizen. Private citizens can use deadly force in situations where they believe they are going to be hurt with serious bodily harm or potential death. It's really the same with police, but police can, it's more expansive in that they can in some situations use deadly force on somebody if they're fleeing a felon, if it's a fleeing felon. But in Wisconsin, that has to be a last resort. and it also has to be a felony that that invoked deadly force, or that a that the individual was fleeing this arrest, and the police could explain somehow that that this flight was going to create imminent likely death or great bodily harm to somebody else. Those are hard for jurors. The fact that this individual is wanted on a warrant, you know, that definitely will come into play. And, you know, sexual assaults are certainly not something that the common citizen believes is an innocuous crime in any way. So I think it's going to be some evidence that may be beneficial to the police officer, but at the end of the day, a jury is going to want to hear, why did you use deadly force, and why did you think it was necessary to do so, no matter how bad of a person this is or what type of a warrant this individual had. I think that it really comes down to, they have to explain the fear that they had, and it has to be a reasonable fear.
Let's just say, and this is a rumor that's out there, this has no factual basis that I'm aware of, but let's just say that the sexual abuse warrant had to do with one of the children, and one of the children, I understand that the children, there are several children, were in the back seat. How would that play into a police officer's right to use deadly force?
Well, I think it would have to be pretty egregious. In other words, that's a lot of knowledge for a police officer to have in a short period of time. My guess is they probably ran his name. He popped on a warrant. The specifics usually are not that detailed. But if, in fact, the police officer had that knowledge, then it would be incumbent upon them to explain why they thought allowing this individual to leave, clearly leaving a lawful arrest, why they thought that would put one or more of the children in imminent danger. And, you know, quite frankly, that would be a fairly big hurdle because, as I said, it really has to be a last resort. And I think jurors are conditioned to believe that there's, you know, a lot of ways that you can stop somebody even when they're in the car. The better example is if somebody was threatening to use that car as a weapon and there was, you know, small children or innocent people standing thereby, and that would justify a quick decision. But it would be hard, I think, in the situation to explain that the sexual assault gave them that fear.
Got it. Let's switch over to the Kyle Rittenhouse situation. And he's the Antioch 17-year-old who came to Kenosha. He said he was going to try to protect some of the businesses there. Tell me, the gun was illegal because he wasn't of age, so that charge we understand. Did you watch some of these videos, and do you understand what happened?
Yeah, I watched the videos, and that's really the extent of my knowledge. I have read a little bit about the case, but you know, as I said earlier, you know, civilians certainly have the right to defend themselves from death or great bodily harm, which would allow them to use deadly force. In great bodily harm, as you know, has been defined by the statute as gaping wounds or severe lacerations, and you know, this guy was struck in the head with, I believe it was a skateboard, and there were a lot of people coming towards him. That could possibly be a self-defense, and it would be an affirmative defense that he would have to raise. And interestingly, with Wisconsin, as with a lot of states, there is no duty to retreat for these individuals, unless in the situation where if somebody provokes the attack in some way, then they do have a duty to retreat. I think the prosecutors would likely argue that him walking through the streets with this assault rifle may have provoked some of these attacks, and then it comes down to, did he have the ability to retreat?
Interesting, because a lot of people, you know, we as lawyers parse things in ways that, you know, I don't know if it's a healthy thing to do or not. But, you know, you say to yourself, wow, he's 17 years old. He's got this very dangerous weapon. How did he get it? What was he doing going up there causing trouble? He, you know, may have asked for it. And so to have him shoot other people because he's up there doing this stupid thing, That's not really the way the law parses it. I mean, am I right that when this case and if this case gets tried and doesn't get plea bargained, we're going to have to look at the moments just before he shot? Now, my understanding is there were two separate parts of that shooting. He shot on one occasion, and then he ran some more, fell down, and shot again. So there are going to be two different episodes where we need to examine what happened immediately preceding that shot that caused him to have that reasonable fear of imminent harm or bodily harm or death. Is that how it's going to go down if it gets tried?
Yeah, that's exactly how it will go down, and I imagine the prosecutors will argue very extensively that they need to inform the trier of fact about the details leading up to the event, such as this individual was from out of state and he came there essentially to confront rioters. The defense will certainly do a motion to limit it and keep that information out, but I think it will probably get in because it's part of the story that needs to be fleshed out so that the trier of fact can figure this out. But yeah, the two separate shootings, and obviously the prosecutors recognize this. One of them was an intentional homicide, and then the other shooting was the reckless disregard. And I don't know which applies to which, but certainly if a unintended individual that unintended from the person that was believed he was in fear of her, if somebody unintended were shot and killed, obviously that could be the reckless charge.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the launch of your new non-for-profit called Bank the Blue. You launched this week. Tell our listeners a little bit about what Bank the Blue is.
Yeah, thanks. We're really excited about this. It's been something that is really it's been a couple years in the making, and it really just started from fear and feelings of discontent watching how police officers were succumbing to a lot of different mental illnesses, which have led to suicides. And the Chicago police suicide rate is astronomical. It's 60% higher than that of the national police rate. And just police in general, it's five times higher than that of the population. So we had that spurned into an idea, and then the idea really it led to a lot of research and interactions with various business leaders and experts in different fields, most importantly the mental health field, and that's really led to what we think is going to be just a great organization. It provides mental health services for police officers, and it also we are going to provide training for police officers to make mindful decisions in these very dangerous situations. We're going to cultivate leadership and enhance decision-making skills for police officers. And very important, I think, is we really wanted to tie in the community with this. And we are going to do an extensive community education training so that police and the citizens that they encounter have a safer experience. And we have teamed up with some of the greatest resources, the mental health individuals. We have the referral list of just extremely reputable individuals, and we've partnered with various organizations that do national training, leadership training for, in some cases, police departments, but in most cases, it's Fortune 500 companies.
Dan,
we're pretty excited about it.
Let me ask you this, and we're just going to have to do this very quickly. Why isn't that the police departments themselves are not providing this intensive work? Because obviously it's needed. Obviously, police officers have stressful jobs that hurt their families, that cause alcoholism, that cause anger problems, and we've seen it. And now it's even worse. Why is it that the police departments are not doing the job they should?
Well, the police departments have definitely recognized the need for it, and they have made some very honorable attempts at at helping in these situations. And there's some very, very good people that are involved that have done some great work. But to be quite candid, it's not enough.
Dan?
The biggest hurdle is that these police officers do not trust going to essentially their departments and seeking support.
Dan, I'm going to have to go. I just heard the buzzer. Dan Herbert, thank you so much for joining me tonight. Stay safe.
Thanks, Karen.
Okay.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.